From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the comedy Night School, starring Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish, directed by Malcolm D. Lee. Also, the animated comedy Smallfoot, which takes us to the world of the Yetis, who aren't sure that humans really exist. And Robert Redford and What He Says is his final screen appearance, starring in The Old Man and the Gun. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film, The Old Man and the Gun, directed by David Lowery and starring Robert Redford in his final on-screen performance, now playing in select theaters.
And National Geographic, presenting Free Solo, a film that follows climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream of climbing El Capitan in Yosemite National Park without a rope. Free Solo opens today at the Arclight Hollywood.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us, along with critics Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of What the Flick, the podcast, and also with us Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com. First up, the comedy Night School, directed by Malcolm D. Lee. It stars Tiffany Haddish and Kevin Hart, who co-wrote the script. Screenplay.
You're the best salesman I've ever seen. I can see you being a stockbroker like me.
Can't you give me a job?
I wish I could. My bosses won't let me hire a dropout.
Look at Mark Zuckerberg.
He dropped out of Harvard. You dropped out of Piedmont High.
I was a couple credits shy of graduating. I got to get my GED.
Tim, what'd you think of Night School?
It's funny. It's kind of funny, just the way it is when you look at those commercials. Tiffany Haddish. Now, this is the thing about this movie. So you have Kevin Hart, who plays that guy, and he loses his job as a barbecue salesman that he's really, really good at. And he has this beautiful, beautiful girl that he wants to get married to. And he's got to figure out a way to make some money. His friend tells him, you know, get your GED. I'll get you a job over here. So he goes to the high school that he went to when he was a kid. And the principal now is this guy who he had some issues with back when they were children. And the night school teacher is played by Tiffany Haddish. So you got these two comedians, Kevin and Tiffany. Mostly what's happening in this movie is they're setting each other up. He sets one up, she smacks it out of the park. She sets one up, it's back and forth. Which means it's really not much of a movie actually going on here. You know, we eventually sort of make our way through the movie. They have this whole classroom of misfits, Romney Malco and all of these people. And they're all funny and they all have their moments. Again, it's not actually a movie, but it is funny. You just sit there and let the jokes come. And they do their little capers and then before you know it's all over. But it's funny. I have to admit, it's actually very funny.
Night School. What'd you think, Christy?
Yeah, so Malcolm D. Lee directed Tiffany Haddish in Girls Trip, which is the movie that made her the great star that she is today. And I wish that the material were as strong for her here and for her and Kevin Hart, despite the fact that he is one of six credited screenwriters here. I mean, you can really feel the cobbling together that has gone on
here.
A lot of jokes.
I was going to say.
It's like the Oscars, all the jokes.
Right. Well, it's almost 2 hours long. It does not need to be. It's like an hour and 51 minutes long. But you wish there was more for them to do. And watching them bounce off of one another made me long for, like, a documentary of the two of them having lunch. You know, we're gonna talk about tea with the dames later on, and I wish this were like that, their energy together.
We should mention Malcolm D. Lee. He directed Undercover Brother, which is a hilarious film.
You know, it's funny, Malcolm, he's Spike's cousin. And, you know, we venerate Spike, and as we should. Malcolm's movies have made 5 times as much money as Spike Lee's movies.
Well, they're safe.
They're funny.
It's just a funny thing.
The Lee who actually makes the money is cousin over there. Yeah, big money.
Each of the people in the class, Rob Riggle, Marilyn Ryska, but they're all stuck in these one-note wacky supporting roles. I would like for them to have had more to do. It's kind of a funny bit where Fat Joe plays this prison inmate who's also getting his GED by Skype, and the way they incorporate him into their antics is kind of amusing here and there. I really wish these really talented people had better material to work with.
Night School, the film rated PG-13, Kevin Hart, Tiffany Haddish star. It's in wide release. Next, the animated adventure comedy Smallfoot, Channing Tatum,
James Corden, Zendaya Common, and LeBron James are the voices in the film that's directed and co-written by Carrie Kirkpatrick. It's based on the book Yeti Tracks by Sergio Pavlos, and it flips the legend of Bigfoot on its head, tells the story of one Yeti's quest to prove to his small mountain tribe humans really do exist.
It's a terrifying creature with perfect white teeth and breath that just smells all minty fresh. And the only hair it has on its entire body is on the top of its head.
Stop it, Migo. You're scaring him.
Sounds rather frantic. Smallfoot is rated PG. Charles.
Well, this is sort of the animated equivalent of a jukebox musical, because you look at it and you say, okay, that's that. I remember that from that. That's that. Again, the premise is that there's a little tribe of Yeti up in the Himalayas. Migo, the kind of goofy misfit, meets an obnoxious PBS host. They become friends, and then we get a civics lesson about, you know, not rejecting people because they're different. Most of the premise comes from Monsters, Inc., as does the designs for the Yeti. The opening is How to Train Your Dragon, with a goat that looks like the sheep in How to Train Your Dragon, just shorn. The dramatic reveal of how the terrible interactions that had taken in the place between humans and Yetis is the hieroglyphic nightmare from Prince of Egypt and the mammoth hunt cave paintings from Ice Age 1. There's an anthem song that sounds like the song from Frozen. There's a rap number that's taken from borrowed from Hamilton.
This is a common refrain in your reviews, Charles, that you know, so many of these movies seem to be cobbling together influences from other better films.
Well, and this feels like it was a film that they were making, and then it got into trouble, and somebody came in and started revising and trying to rearrange enough pieces to save it.
There are only two screenwriters, unlike Night School.
I don't know. Again, I just was looking in vain for something really new and really original. Even the human who's, again, really obnoxious, who's doing anything for ratings. He'll dress up in a fake Yeti suit. And he's Jonathan from Hotel Transylvania with different hair and animation that isn't as good.
Speaking of the writers, Sarah and Carrie Kirkpatrick are the screenwriters. Kirkpatrick directing. Christy, what do you think?
One of the main influences that Charles did not mention was the Lego movie. Because there's a giant production number off the top where the Channing Tatum Yeti, who is essentially like Emmett in Lego movie, is singing a song that is thematically everything is awesome, but not nearly as catchy. It's basically, we like live in this way. The fundamental premise here is actually kind of groundbreaking in some ways. It tells kids, question authority, question religion, question everything you've been taught, think for yourself. And I love the idea of that. The Common provides a voice of the stone keeper, who is the leader of this Yeti colony. And he wears this vestment of literal stones that each are inscribed with the rules they all must live by. It's like, instead of the 10 commandments, it's like 1,000 commandments. And he lies to people to protect them, quote unquote. And I just wish that the visuals matched the kind of subversive nature of the theme here, because the characters are all blandly the same in colors of cream and blue. Yeah, the script is pretty trite. Yeah.
Not very diverse Yetis, it sounds like. Tim, what do you think?
Well, yeah, what they say is completely true. It's all incredibly derivative. It just is. It is. Now, but I have to say this about it. It's not bad. It isn't. It's just a sort of incredibly ordinary, you go along, and I laughed at a lot of those jokes. I laughed at them the first time I saw them in the other movies. They're still funny. So I'm sitting there, and yes, I'm in this movie that's insanely derivative, and it still makes me giggle. It's a big hit. But I got to tell you, most American animation kind of lives in this zone. This is where it is. The problem is they're very often derivative of movies that aren't very old. I wouldn't mind it if you were giving me, you know, derivations of,
Pinocchio.
Thank you. Go to that. But, you know, they made that movie like 2 years ago, How to Train Your Dragon. They already made that movie. It's just, you know, it's still
but
fresh.
But Pixar gets away with not being derivative. Certainly the great Japanese animation houses are not derivative. So how come they do it and so many of these others feel like cobbled together semi-knockoffs?
Well, if I can jump in for Tim there, a lot of it is that if you're risking so many tens of millions of dollars on a movie, you're probably going to take what's safe and tried and true. The Japanese directors are spending much, much less money, like orders of magnitude less. And Pixar is an entity unto itself. And I'm very happy that it's sort of gotten over its sequels phase and could give us Coco and Inside Out, which are wonderful movies and very original.
Well, and even their sequels, for the most part, I would argue, are not just redos of the earlier film. Each Toy Story film, I would argue, is very distinct.
Yeah. And in some ways, they get better.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. I cried at Toy Story 3. I cried at Toy Story 2. That was the film that proved the first time that CG could make an audience cry when Jesse's song comes on. Mm. Man, the water pumps.
Mm. And fact,
I was going to say, I'm blanking out, the voice of Woody.
Tom
Hanks told me that he and Tim Allen had missed the screenings of that film. They went to the theater together and he said, you had two 40-year-old men blubbering their eyes out over a lost cowgirl doll.
We should mention, Charles, you've written the authoritative book on the Toy Story films. So that is available with beautiful illustrations as well as Charles' outstanding interviews and text for that book. The movie we're reviewing today, not at that level, Smallfoot, is a Warner Brothers animated film rated PG. It's in wide release. Next up, The Old Man and the Gun, a comedic drama starring Robert Redford and what he says will be his last acting performance. Casey Affleck, Sissy Spacek, Danny Glover, Tom Waits, written and directed by David Lowry, who based his screenplay on a 2003 David Grann New Yorker article, tells the story of the gentlemanly con artist Forrest Tucker, his escape from prison, and his string of bank heists that captivated the nation.
Well, let's take this place. Say it was a bank, and instead of that counter up there, that was really a teller's window, and you just walk in real calm. So you walk right up, look her in the eye, and you say, ma'am, this is a robbery. And you show her the gun like this, and you say, I wouldn't want you to get hurt, because I like you.
The Old Man and the Gun, Christy.
Completely charming. Robert Redford is a movie star. In case you didn't know, or in case you'd forgotten, or it's been a while, this movie celebrates him as a movie star in various incarnations throughout his career. But even at this age, at what, 82 he is?
Yeah.
I mean, he's got that thing, that magnetic, gorgeous thing, the twinkle in his eye and the smile, the sly smile. And he and Sissy Spacek have just this wonderful chemistry here together. So he's playing this bank robber who just pulled off a bunch of bank heists just by walking in and being charming. And he never pulls a gun, actually. He just kind of gives a low-key welcoming spiel to whoever the young teller happens to be and walks out. And it's about how Casey Affleck, who is this Dallas police officer, goes after him in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a low-key kind of Shaggy Hang version of Catch Me If You Can. Because you are rooting for the con artist to get away with it. He's so lovely. And he's not really hurting anybody. You know, he seems happy. No one ever gets shot or killed or anything in these heists. And it's about how he just sort of enjoys these twilight days of his life. But increasingly, Casey Affleck is on his case. David Lowry makes these films that are just deeply steeped in 70s period detail.
What are some of his earlier films?
Ain't Them Bodies Saints,
Ghost Story.
A Ghost Story. Yeah. Even his Pete's Dragon that he did, which was a 70s film, his version of it with high-tech abilities still had that sort of charming, innocent feel of a action movie from a family film from the 70s. So the pacing, it's shot digitally, but there's like a grainy kind of tactile nature to the look of the film.
Saw that in the trailer. Yes. I wasn't sure if the movie really looked that way or was just a bad print of the trailer.
It is totally intentional. I mean, everything is very specific and detailed, down to the opening titles from the very first second of this film. You know you are in the hands of somebody who is trying to create an evocative mood, and yet it's not full-blown parody to the extent of like a Tarantino film.
Yeah, right.
It's really lovely. It's charming and light and lovely.
Loosely based on an actual guy named Forrest Tucker. who was a lifelong sort of con artist and mostly bank robber.
This is not the actor Forrest Tucker.
Not the actor Forrest Tucker, who only probably you and I know. And we sort of pick it up as he sort of escapes from I think San Quentin. And he meets Sissy Spacek and pretends to be able to fix her truck, but he can't fix her truck. And they just sort of take up this relationship. What I like about this film, a couple things. One, despite the title, you only see that gun one time in this movie. And I like that he is an affable liar. He just lies all the way, but never to hurt anyone. Only to make people feel better, and only to make things pretty good. But he's a liar.
Spacek, again, just seeing the trailer of this, it was so great to see her back in a major role. How's the performance?
She's wonderful in this movie. And the thing of it is, she figures out pretty quick, this guy's a liar, but he's fun.
The Old Man and the Gun, starring Robert Redford, Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, Tom Waits, and Sissy Spacek. David Lowry, the writer and director. It's rated PG-13. It's screening at the Arclight in Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Coming up, we'll hear what Christy, Tim, and Charles think about all the other films this week, including Tea with the Dames. That's coming up on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. This is Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. And let me reintroduce our terrific critics with us: Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon. The horror film Hellfest was not screened for critics. Even Tim didn't. Tim, you usually get up in the middle of the night to go see it.
I looked for it real hard, but, you know, there it is. Yeah.
Not enough of a fest to be found, so we can't tell you about that. But we can tell you about something completely different, the documentary Tea with the Dames. Dames Eileen Atkins, Judy Dench, Joan Plowright, and Maggie Smith, their friendship is detailed. Tim, what did you think of the documentary?
Well, this is just wonderful. It really, really is. I mean, we start the film with them sitting around the table in a garden, an English garden, and they really haven't even started the film yet. The cameras are still being set up, and the ladies are chit-chatting and talking. And this is just wonderful because they are unguarded, and they say everything they are actually thinking. Foul mouth. Joan Plowright, who is both a lady and a dame, by the way. I mean, that's a twofer. That's a big deal.
Oh, widow of Sir Lawrence Olivier.
The widow of Sir. And beautiful stories they tell. I don't know why I didn't know that they would have obviously have known each other all of this time.
Well, sometimes you think with actors that egos can get, I mean, particularly at this level.
Particularly in Hollywood.
They all come
out of the real Shakespeare. Maggie Smith has a wonderful story that when she was working with Laurence Olivier, she was Desdemona. He hit her so hard, he knocked her out. And then she adds, it was the only time I saw stars at the National Theater.
What a great line.
But they're also, I think, most compelling when they are talking about their art. When Judy Dench talks about how you have to rise to the poetry of a role in Shakespeare, you're suddenly getting insights into what makes this woman such an extraordinary performer. And then she bounces back with being asked to play Shakespeare's Cleopatra and asking, well, do you want a menopausal dwarf in that role?
They talk about how they were all not considered great beauties. And I think this is interesting because it puts the lie to the notion that the pretty ingenue is the only thing that these women rose above any sort of ideas about that kind of stuff. It's just, you know, it's really just a strike. Roger Michel directing, you know, Notting Hill.
Yeah.
Love Actually.
Yeah. Tea with the Dames. What did you think, Christy?
This could have gone on forever. It's only like an hour and a half long, and it's like, oh, I don't want to leave yet. Their chemistry is so lovely. I was especially impressed by the way they all kind of dote on Joan Plowright. She's the eldest of them. Her vision is going, and they're so kind to her. I mean, they all tool on each other in an affectionate way. You know, they've been friends for decades, and there is some affectionate kind of ribbing of each other. They all have such wonderful history, but they're so kind to Joan Plowright, and they're at the house, her country home, with Larry that they shared. One thing too that's really cool is for younger or newer film viewers who maybe only know Maggie Smith as Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter movies, you see
see so much wonderful archival footage of these actresses, both from their theater days, from their early film days. Yes, they are very candid about the way they have been perceived and how and why they have been cast in certain roles. They are very clear-eyed and just lovely.
Go ahead, Chuck. I defer. Something
Tim and I were talking about before the show is there's so much footage from their live performances that I had no idea existed. I saw Maggie Smith on the stage once when I was still in college and have been in love with her ever since, but I didn't know that that had ever been filmed or so many of her other stage vehicles had been filmed.
It was just astounding how many of these plays were shot in one way or another. There's footage in this film of Dame Judi Dench at age 18. It's breathtaking. Yeah. In a role.
And I suspect the talent was very evident at 18.
What Christy was saying about Redford, you just look at him and that's a star. You cannot look away from those performances.
Christy, do they get into the issue at all of having this reverential status? We don't really have anything equivalent. I mean, we have like Robert Redford or Clint Eastwood aging, you know, movie stars. But we don't have that sir and dame status being knighted. Did they talk at all about that and maybe people, you know, being intimidated by that or being put on that pedestal?
They talk about what it meant to them to achieve that title. And we do see footage from each of them receiving the honor, whether it's from Queen Elizabeth or from Prince Charles. You see that they're humbled by it. And that's lovely and highfalutin and all that. But one thing that's so cool about this film is that it also reminds you, these were women who were young in the 60s in London.
Yeah.
And so it sort of tears away at the highfalutin, frilly notion of what a dame is supposed to be.
All right. We're talking about the documentary from director Roger Michell, Tea with the Dames, Eileen Atkins, Judi Dench, Joan Plowright, and Maggie Smith, friends who get together, talk about their career. The film is unrated. You can see it appropriately at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Monsters and Men, a drama that stars Anthony Ramos, John David Washington, and Kelvin Harrison Jr. The film is written and directed by Ronaldo Marcus Green, making his feature writing and directorial debut. Christy?
This film is excellent, and it might be my absolute favorite of the week, in a week where we do have really cool stuff like Tea with the Dames. This is yet another film that tackles the subject of police shootings. We've had several in recent years. We have several this year alone between Blind Spotting, which came out a few months ago. Next week, we have The Hate U Give. We've had documentaries like Whose Streets about Ferguson. Here you have a police shooting that takes place in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. And we see it from three different perspectives. One from a young man who is a young father and trying to make money and trying to get out of the projects with his girlfriend where he lives with his baby and his mom. And he witnesses the shooting and happens to shoot video of it on his phone. The second perspective is from John David Washington, son of Denzel, who's so great in Black Klansman. He is a police officer on the beat in this part of Brooklyn, and it's about him feeling torn between his loyalty to the force, but also saying what he knows is true about the officer who did the shooting. And then the third part comes from a young man who, Kelvin Harrison Jr., who is primed for baseball greatness. He's a high school student. Like the next day, he's got this showcase with these scouts from various MLB teams. But he is getting more and more into this movement of, you know, Black Lives Matter and protests. And he's a young black man going to a very exclusive private school. And he's torn between what his true identity is. And it's really beautifully shot. It's elegant, but in a non-showy way. Just beautiful, intimate camera work and long takes and a really vivid sense of place. Very early on in the film, Ronaldo Marcus Green, it's amazing this is only his first film. He establishes very quickly and very efficiently the rhythms of this neighborhood, the rhythms of this particular corner where this bodega is, where the shooting occurred, where the victim was just a mainstay in the neighborhood and a favorite of everyone who was shot for absolutely no reason. And it takes a really complicated topic, one that is
all too relevant and looks at it from a variety of perspectives. I wish there were more of a female perspective here is my only complaint, because it is from three different male perspectives.
Is it like Rashomon perspective?
It's not. Because they're not contradictory.
Okay.
It's just you learn a little more each time. And there's only a vague bit of intersection between a couple of the storylines. But it's really... it's lovely and powerful and like quietly potent and very much worth seeing.
Monsters and Men, the drama we're talking about, written and directed by Ronaldo Marcus Green, starring Anthony Ramos, John David Washington, and Calvin Harrison Jr. The Frames' John Horn spoke with the director, Ronaldo Marcus Green, and the star, Anthony Ramos, that was earlier this week on KPCC. You can hear that interview at kpcc.org/The Frame. We also have a link on our Film Week page as well. Monsters and Men is showing at the ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark West LA, and the AMC Burbank Theater. It's rated R. All About Nina stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Common. It's written and directed by Eva Vives. It's her feature writing and directorial debut as well. Tim?
Yeah. Kind of feels like a debut for the director-writer, particularly some of the dialogue and whatnot. But I'll tell you this. She did write by casting young Mary Elizabeth Winstead in this movie. She is fantastic in this movie. She's far and away the best thing in the movie, and she makes the movie better. She plays this comic, young stand-up comedian, kind of angry, a little self-destructive. Her humor is extremely biting, the kind of stuff that makes you uncomfortable. But so funny. So funny. She's working in New York, and she gets a shot at being on some big old show out here in California. So she makes her way out here, and she's getting herself ready to go on the show. There are sequences in this movie where we see her preparing her stand-up, voices that she has to do and all this kind of stuff, and she is just killing this stuff. You know, in the mirror, Cher, Sonny, just wonderfully funny. Then we see her on stage doing her routine. She is funny. Self-destructive, though. She gets involved in a relationship with Common, just a brother, hanging around, sees her at the comedy club. And they start having this sort of interesting back and forth. And it becomes an issue of exactly where is she coming from. Plainly, she's got some problems. He's not always completely truthful. What's going to happen?
The movie, so it's kinda a bit of a relational mystery.
Yeah. And it kind of goes off the rails a little bit for me toward the end with some of the things. A lot of it is very personal to the writer-director here. It has a lot to do with her life. I would have rather it stayed contained within a much simpler, less dramatic story, because I think the movie was that good. But like I said, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, breathtaking.
Christy.
She's so great in this, and she is somebody who we've seen quite a bit in several indies, including, did you ever see Smashed?
Oh, yeah.
Where she plays an alcoholic.
Yeah.
She is so fearless, and she will go to these dark places, and she's strikingly beautiful, but she's not afraid to look ugly and inwardly and outwardly. And yeah, the comedy is really raw and really biting, and it's meant to make you think and make you feel and make you uncomfortable. She's not here to make friends. She's here to work through some issues. I know you say that, Tim, you think it goes off the rails toward the end. I feel like it gets more focused as who she is becomes clearer, and what it is that drives her, and what it is that makes her self-sabotaging. Mm. You feel for her. It's all out there in front of her. Why can't she make it work? Why can't she figure her stuff out? And increasingly, you begin to understand why that is when she eventually becomes willing to face her own uncomfortable truths. And I feel like it gets more focused and more powerful in like a hold your breath kind of way. There's one long monologue she gives, and it's just stunning. Mm. And
some of what's going on in this film are questions about what's the point of comedy. And we've had some issues. Roseanne, going all the way back to Mike Richards and all that kind of stuff. What are comedians doing? What are they allowed to do? This film is asking some questions about that. And I think, that's something that we're going to have to grapple with a little bit here. Is the comedian allowed to go all the way there, even if they fail? Can they try? And if they try and fail, are we going to make them stay down? This movie is asking about that.
Yeah, I was concerned at first that it was going to be like a making fun of L.A. movie because they do make fun of like L.A. through her New Yorker eyes. But it's more substantive than that.
Yeah. The movie is all about Nina and the director of the film, Eva Vives, who makes her feature directorial debut, was interviewed by The Frame's John Horn earlier this week. And once again, the full interview with John at kpcc.org/theframe. We also have a link to that on our Film Week page. All About Nina stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Common. The film is at the Arclight Hollywood and the AMC Sunset in West Hollywood. It's rated R. Coming up, Charles is going to tell us about the Japanese anime film My Hero Academia, Two Heroes. We'll also hear about the latest version of Little Women and more. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, back with our trio of critics very shortly. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. And got a terrific trio of critics, Tim Cogshell, Charles Solomon, and Christy Lemire, all joining us with their reviews. Charles is up next with the animated film, the Japanese anime, My Hero Academia, Two Heroes, directed by Kenji Nagasaki. Charles?
Well, this is one of those franchises you accuse me of making up, Larry. It's very much one of the up-and-coming new properties from Japan. It's hugely popular, especially with kids, college students, high school students, even younger. They've sold more than 14 million books of the manga in 3 years.
Wow.
This anime is already in its third season, though we've only gotten two over here. It's about a high school for superheroes, and Deku, the main character, is one of the few kids born without a superpower. So he grows up the ultimate fanboy, but he's so heroic, so dedicated to helping others, that All Might, the greatest of superheroes, finds a way to pass on his powers to him. But like Spider-Man, he's got this huge learning curve. And in this case, they go to an island that serves as a lab for all the world's great scientists to see a friend of All Might's. He has a daughter who actually likes Deku. This is a first. This brilliant, very attractive girl likes him and wants to work with him and help him grow stronger. There's a hostage crisis that the kids and some more friends from the high school have to resolve. If you like My Hero Academia, it gives you exactly what you want. It's fun. It's adventure. It's excitement. It's friendship. Just lots of fun. Not a great film by any means, but for everyone who loves this property, you'll have a ball. And it was number three at the box office, wow, part of last week.
I have to say, these films that you make up, Charles, they do sound very entertaining.
I stay up nights before I come on.
My Hero Academia, Two Heroes, Japanese anime, the film from Kenji Nagasaki. It's unrated, and you can see it at selected theaters in Southern California. Little Women, the new version, stars Leah Thompson, Melanie Stone, Sarah Davenport, Lise Jones, Ali Jennings, and Taylor Murphy. Claire Niederpruem is the director and co-screenwriter of the film. Christy?
This is yet another version of Little Women.
Does anyone know how many there are?
A lot, and we're getting one more next year, too, because Greta Gerwig is doing Little Women.
That's
With Saoirse Ronan as Jo and Timothée Chalamet as Laurie. This is not that.
Well, there are a lot of them, but there are only two that matter. Kate Hepburn in the 30s.
Yeah.
In the early 90s,
yeah.
That one with
Winona Ryder and Christian Bale.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a terrific version.
Gillian Armstrong film.
This is none of those.
Yeah,
this
not the George Cukor film.
No,
it's not.
This is a modern day telling of Little Women, which is kind of a daring thing to do. Seems kind of anachronistic given that the characters aren't terribly modern. The setting is modern, but they're like homeschooled and they're still kind of prim, and they're still very true to who these characters are. It just happens to take place now. There's also a time hop element that's very confusing because the actress playing Jo, Sarah Davenport, looks exactly the same, like, now, but also 10 years ago. So it's like, is she home from college? Is she a grown-up? It's very confusing. Anyway, it's Little Women, as you know it to be. It's just it takes place now. It's very empty emotionally
and feels very rushed and very cursory. And again, the Joe performance is like manic and wild-eyed.
How do you make Little Women unemotional?
It's not. I mean, even, you know, spoiler, somebody dies. But, I mean, even that doesn't carry the kind of emotional punch that you expect it to.
It's infused with all kinds of, it's overwrought with emotion, which makes it unemotional because it's like, I don't buy a single thing that any, and Joe, she's psychotic. She needs to be on Ritalin or something.
Wild-eyed.
Just, you know, and kicking things over. And I'm like, no, that would not work. So, no, it doesn't work at all. I don't know why did they keep that language? Why didn't she let it settle into the modern world? I mean, I'm asking this question. So,
I have no answer
so
for you.
So glad you asked.
Yeah, it's a weird hybrid, and it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, very.
Little Women from director Claire Niederpruem, who co-wrote the screenplay, of course, based on the Louisa May Alcott novel, gets rated PG-13 in wide release. The documentary Bad Reputation tells the story of rocker Joan Jett's life. Kevin Kerslake is the director. Tim?
Yeah. Let's see. When The Runaway happened, 1975. Joan Jett and all the girls who were in that band were about 15 girls on stage with those guitars singing that punk music, playing. It just, you know, I was like 14, so I was done, and I've been with Joan ever since. And so Joan Jett is really an interesting story, much more interesting than one might think. The way she sort of rose to stardom, she didn't really intend. She was not the front person of that band, and all the story of all of that sort of happens in this movie, and we see what went down there, and then we see how she sort of breaks away and has to find her own identity. Goes to the UK, meets Sid Vicious and all those kind of, and starts to put together a sort of feel for herself. What's really interesting is when she meets Kenny Laguna, who had been a writer of Bubblegum Pop. You remember those songs by the Archies?
Oh, yeah, sure, Sugar, Sugar, Sugar.
Yeah, he wrote those songs, yeah. All those kinds of, which were like these things back in the day. And the notion of him hooking up with Joan Jett and creating the music of the Blackhearts, it's just strange, man. But they did. And for the next 35 years, those two together created Blackheart and just built this rocking career for Joan Jett.
Christy, what did you think of Bad Reputation?
Yeah, I dug it. It made me appreciate how enduring Joan Jett is. I mean, you just take for granted how trailblazing she was. She just seems to have always been there. And she is still doing exactly what she has always done. You know, unlike Madonna, who reinvents herself every 5 years, 10 years. Like, Joan Jett is still Joan Jett. Like,
yeah, she's uncut. Punk rock star.
Yeah, and I, too, was blown away by the revelation that I Hate Myself for Loving You and I Love Rock and Roll. Those are all just bubblegum songs, like 2-minute songs that begin with a chorus that have an insanely catchy hook, mm-hmm. but there's just more of an edge to them. I'm like, oh, this makes sense now. So you come to appreciate music and a musician through fresh eyes.
Bad Reputation documentary on Joan Jett. It's rated R. Kevin Kerslake, the director. It's at the New Art Theater in West L.A. The documentary Free Solo is about climbing Yosemite's El Capitan wall. The documentary directed by Elizabeth Chai Vassalrelli and Jimmy Chin. Christy.
If you have a fear of heights, if you are even vaguely uncomfortable, like being in an elevator or being at the top of a building, this is not the movie for you. It is a National Geographic documentary, and so it is beautifully shot. And it is about this young man named Alex Honnold, who is the only first and only person ever to free climb El Capitan. He had done it many, many times with ropes, and it is notoriously treacherous and has myriad challenges all over the place. He did it without ropes, and you see him along the way at various points, like now he's 200 feet up, now he's 2,000 feet up, and even watching him practice it is just like my hands are sweating just remembering, watching it. And so you see his singularity in rehearsing for this and training for this, and he's lived in a van for like 9 years, and he's got a girlfriend, and she comes to visit him in the van. And you've got to have that kind of focus, you've got to have that kind of like ice water in your veins to not freak out at the possibility of like plummeting to your death. It's really cool and terrifying. I'm really happy I get to moderate some Q&As over the weekend. If you go to the ArcLight
to the 12:30 or 3 o'clock shows. I'm going to moderate Q&As with Alex. And
that's Saturday.
Saturday
you're doing it.
And Sunday.
So we'll miss the first one because we're on the air right now during your first one. But the second one we'll be able to.
Time has collapsed on itself. Yes.
Tim,
look, some fantastic filmmaking in this film. So right there with them, use of drones and other climbers on the wall and all. I can see all of that. But look, I have to say this. I don't like these films. I don't like these people. I don't like these daredevil things. I don't like any of this. None of this makes any sense.
Christy's got to talk with these people today.
I'm sorry. This is just all, it's frankly moronic to me. It's just ridiculous.
I'll tell them that for you.
It makes no sense to me. I understand this must be a certain kind of human that does these sort of things, like a person. But this is all moronic to me, and I have no idea.
So the adrenaline junkie, the ultimate challenge thing, you don't buy that.
Well, look, adrenaline. Nope. Why not engage in something actually useful? The only thing you can do by free climbing on that rock is either make it to the top or fall off and die. Those are the only two choices. Neither one are particularly interesting to me.
All right. No. Send your emails if you're a climber to to Tim. I got a wrap. Free Solo tells the story of Alex Honnold. He and his girlfriend is featured in the film. We'll be with Christy. That's at the Arclight Hollywood 3 o'clock this afternoon following the screening of the documentary. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We're back in just 1 minute.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic, presenting Free Solo from the directors of Meru, hailed by critics as a stunning real-world thriller and an experience that will leave you in awe. Free Solo is the breathtaking portrait of climber Alex Honnold as he prepares to achieve his lifelong dream, climbing the face of the world's most famous rock, the 3,200-foot El Capitan in Yosemite National Park, without a rope. Free Solo opens today at the Arclight Hollywood.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film, The Old Man and the Gun. Robert Redford stars in his final on-screen performance with Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, Tom Waits, and Sissy Spacek, now playing in select theaters.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Our critics this week, Tim Cogshell joining us, Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon. We're going to close out by focusing on African-American majority cast films or films that have Black themes. You know, one of the arguments that we've heard from, you know, studios, people in the film business, for why we don't see more African-American themes or more Black dominant casts in film, is particularly at the higher budget level, is because they supposedly do not travel well internationally. But the question is, with Black Panther, with the success domestically of Sorry to Bother You that's out recently, Moonlight, is this in fact true, or is this a myth that's been perpetuated without evidence? Joining us, contributor to Forbes, who covers the film industry, Scott Mendelson. Scott, good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So is Black Panther and how it did internationally kind of a referendum on this notion?
It should be, because quite frankly, it did about as well, if not better, than most superhero films at that top-tier level have done overseas. Yes, it overperformed in North America, so you've got more closer to a 50-50 split domestic overseas versus a more, a conventional global blockbuster that tends to do 40-60 or 35-65. But both in terms of raw dollars, the film made $1.345 billion, and in terms of making quite a bit of money overseas, including in China. I think the film is evidence that either audiences are willing to, if not eager to, embrace more diverse big-budget tentpole films, or they're not necessarily scared away by the idea of a film like that that doesn't star a white guy.
Scott Mendelson of Forbes with us. Tim, I wanted to ask you, because my assumption has always been it's the type of film, and that we haven't had the same types of films that make all the big international money aren't the types of films that we have traditionally had black majority casts or black themed films.
It's an interesting thing because we really are talking about two different things here. We're talking about films that are black themed and films that might feature black stars and cast, but are not necessarily. So Denzel Washington is hardly ever in a black themed film.
Right.
But he headlines movies that play all over the world all the time. Same thing with Will Smith. We can go, litany of Eddie Murphy for years and years and years. These were black movie stars in films that traveled all over the world, but they weren't making black themed films.
Well, and they weren't typically black dominant casts.
Exactly. Also. Yeah, the leads would be black. Then you have films that are big black casts, but not necessarily black themed.
Black Panther.
And then you have themes that are black films that are black themed. This is a black cast about black people talking about black stuff. Now this is all very, very complicated, and all of these films perform differently depending on where you're talking about and what kind of movie you're talking about, who the stars are. And now I think we're starting to see that all of these films have a potential of playing all around the world because millennials all around the world engage these things differently than even my generation or the generation behind my generation. Millennials now, when you give them something called a black-themed film, they're going to know about the content of that film. Why? Because they listen to hip-hop all day, every day. And whatever they're talking about in that black-themed film with those black folks,
it's not foreign to them.
It's not literally not foreign to them.
Yeah, Scott, let me come back to you, Scott Mendelson of Forbes. How did Get Out, for example, do internationally?
Well, I'm going off memory, so bear with me. I know it did $175 million domestic, and it did, I think, about $255 million worldwide. So, yes, you have a film that... You have a lot of films of this nature that, yes, they make more money in North America than they do overseas, but they still make a decent chunk of change overseas. And when you have a movie like Get Out that costs, I think, like $5, $6 million, or even something like Girls Trip that costs, $17 million, it doesn't have to be 50-50 if you're not spending $200 million to make the movie.
Yeah, that's a good point. I raise Get Out because it's not a black film, but the creator of it is an African-American filmmaker, and the themes of race are very front and center in the movie. Charles?
I'm picking up on what Tim was saying, that in a lot of Asia, you still see, in some cases, like advertising or costumes, very unflattering images of Africans and African Americans. But hip hop and jazz are extraordinarily popular. Everybody from Haruki Murakami to many of the anime directors have jazz soundtracks. There are huge dance parties in Yoyogi Park every week, people dancing hip hop and wanting to dress hip hop.
Yeah, jazz artists regularly travel to Japan on tour.
Yeah,
man, because you'll make more money. Black people invented jazz, but the Japanese like it better than we do. It's the most bizarre thing in the world. But African American cultures do travel all over the world. You see it every place: dress, hair. When I was in Japan, Osaka, 3 years ago, all these Japanese kids walking around with afros. They did something bizarre to their hair to get the fluff, That's black culture penetrating those communities. So this notion that these cultures, our cinema anyway, won't travel, not true. Simply not true. Not true anymore if it ever were true.
So, Scott, my question is, what's your sense of filmmakers? Is this starting to change, this assumption that African-American-themed films don't travel?
Well, a yes with a pencil. Because I fear, as I'm sure we all fear, that the executives the studio executives, the quote unquote powers that be, will find a way to maintain the conventional wisdom, either because a major high profile black or, generally speaking, female driven film might flop, or there'll be a film that's very, very conventionally generic white guy blockbuster, the movie that'll make $800 million worldwide. And they'll go, oh, no, we need to go back to making this kind of film. But having said that, what I've noticed the last couple of years, and in 5 years I may look stupid for saying this, but in China specifically, it's films like Black Panther are doing as well in China and overseas as they would a generic quote-unquote white guy superhero movie. Same thing with something like Wonder Woman or Ant-Man and the Wasp. In fact, a lot of movies that you would consider to be quote-unquote unconventional wisdom in terms of starring a minority or a woman, a lot of these films like Tomb Raider, Ghost in the Shell, Pacific Rim Uprising, XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, Coco, Ant-Man and the Wasp, they either don't do well in North America or they do pretty well in North America, but they do really well overseas. Mm. So I think in a lot of cases, it is the overseas audiences that are supporting these movies and breaking that quote-unquote glass ceiling more so than North American audiences that try to hold themselves as so pious.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, because I think what's underlying this is sort of the argument that essentially international audiences are racist against African Americans.
That's exactly
that's
the
really the
thing.
Argument yeah. is that no, they will not accept them because they're biased against them. And Tim, do you think the numbers are starting to prove the lie to that?
Oh yeah, and probably have been. For one thing, we can't really test these numbers because there haven't been enough films over the course of many decades
such a small sample.
Little things though, it makes a difference. In this way. Think about a film like the original Green Lantern starring Ryan Reynolds. Now, in America, the Green Lantern that everybody thought they were going to make with that film was a guy named John Brown, right? A black Green Lantern. There are lots of Green Lanterns. But they didn't make that one. They made the one with the white guy. Why? They thought the one with the white guy would travel better. Ryan Reynolds don't play Green Lantern no more because that film flopped. Next time, make it with a brother.
All right. Well, that's a great. That hey, Scott, I got to wrap. Thanks. Tim Cockshell, thanks so much. Christy Lemire, Scott Mendelson joining us, a contributor to Forbes, where he covers the film industry, and Charles Solomon, animation critic, with us as well. Have a terrific rest of your afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Film Week on KPCC.